consider tonight something of the meaning of the individuated state, what it means to be an individual observer from oneself and in relation with other observers. We'll start with our familiar circle, and we can consider this circle either as the boundary of a substance or the boundary of a whole. We draw two little ones to illustrate the same thing. We'll shade one of the circles and say that is a substantialized sphere, and we'll shade round the other one and say that one is a whole in substance. You'll see immediately that if we consider one as a substantial sphere, it has a peculiar feeling of isolation. Whereas if we consider a substance with a hole in it, we don't get the same sense of isolation. The hole, the thing that you can pass through, doesn't seem quite so isolated as the same symbol when it is considered as a substance. You've seen this thing in the classical Chinese diagram, with the circle and half of it dark with a white spot, half of it light with a dark spot. You know that symbolizes the yin and yang of the Chinese, the yin female, yang male forces. And you can see in the diagram that the little black dot in the white looks very isolated, whilst the white one in the dark, if considered as a whole in the dark, does not look isolated. Now supposing we say that the black dot represents substance, when viewed as mass inertia, we'll put the letter M in to represent substance, viewed from outside as a sphere, it is a form. We would then say it is a substantial form. We have to view it from outside to see its spherical form. We have to feel its resistance to consider it as a substance. We have to press against it and feel it resisting our pressure. And when we put an observer on the other diagram and look through the hole, imagine we look through the hole in substance, we don't get the feeling that the hole is an isolated entity like we do when we consider the substantial sphere. We get the sensation that the whole is somehow surrounded by substance. It's therefore not isolated. It's not surrounded by nothing, the substantial sphere. It is a whole surrounded by substance. So the whole feels slightly more comfortable, more belonging, more in relation than the substantial sphere does. We can equate this with male and femaleness when we consider the isolation in one case to be male and this whole within substance to be not an isolation thing but a relation. Somehow there's a sense of relation when we drill a hole in a piece of wood. The whole is related to the wood in a very peculiar way. The substance of the wood embraces the whole, and so you get a sensation of protection round the whole. There's nothing in the centre, and round it there is protection. Whereas in the case of the spherical substance, the billiard ball, there is nothing round it to protect it, and it is exposed. This exposedness of form, which is called masculine, and this non-existent receptivity surrounded by a substance, we can call feminine. And we can remind ourselves of these two simultaneously when we come to look at an individual. Let us imagine for a moment that we start drawing a line drawing, such as we see sometimes in advertisements, where a line, like a television screen, is taken across the page, and it's quite thick as it goes across a certain part, and then it goes thin a certain distance, and it goes thick again. Imagine we keep drawing this thick line, very thin line, thick line. Now you know that if we outline a face a little bit, and map the shadow areas in it, and then start drawing lines across, thick and thin, you can gradually build up a sensation as if a face exists, and this face is actually no more than lines, but the thickening of the lines in certain places gives the sense of form. So we can say, we can consider this circle as traversed by lines of force of relatively different densities. If the lines of force are heavy, it will appear to be substantial, and if the lines of force are thin, it will appear to be non-substantial. But really all the time it's exactly the same ultimate power that is functioning in that way. When we draw the circle, we've drawn the limiting factor to a zone. If we like to shade it in and pretend it's a substantial being, as soon as we get this and view it from outside at its edges, we give rise to the sensation of isolation and individuation when viewed from outside. Thus, if you look at your hand from outside, look at the form of it, you get the impression that somehow your hand is existing in space, and you can conceive your hand cut off and isolated. And because you can look at it from outside, it looks cut off, isolated, bound by a contour. But if you close your eyes and feel inside your hand, it does not feel isolated. Your consciousness is identified with the feeling in the place of the hand, and it has a peculiar sense of relation. You don't feel cut off from it. So when you are at the feeling level on the inside of a thing, you feel in relation. Whereas when you identify with the form viewed from outside, you feel isolated. Let's apply this to any human individual. A human individual can identify with his finite physical body. He can think of himself as sitting in space, surrounded by space. And he is at the center, and he's looking from outside at himself. When he does this, he feels small, identified with finity, and he feels isolated. He feels he is a material body occupying infinite space, and he experiences this space as an infinite otherness to his own individuality, and therefore this infinite otherness, this infinite, threatens his very existence, because it could absorb all the energy of that body into infinity. It could annihilate it by simply absorbing it. So if we identify with the body as form, we expose ourselves to the fear that the infinite might absorb us. That's our experience from outside. Shade the body. Now another way is to imagine that we are inside a continuum of power, and that the power in the place of our body is spinning. It's rotating. We know this is true of every material particle in our body. And we will say that as it is spinning, we can consider that it is tending to exhaust the space inside the boundary. In other words, it is moving towards the perimeter, all the force that is inside it, and packing it on the perimeter, and thus leaving a hole, an emptiness in the middle. And when we do this, we imagine that we are carrying all we have to the perimeter of being from the inside. We now feel the pressure of infinity from outside threatening to press on us, forcing us to our center and reducing us. We now have another kind of experience of a fear, the fear that we might possibly be pressed upon by infinity down to an infinitesimally small point. These are two opposite fears. One arising from the idea when we are the substance, that we might be absorbed by the infinite space around, and the other one, that if we are a cleared space of consciousness, we might be reduced by the pressure of the world around us and become smaller and smaller until we finally disappear. These are the two basic fears that we experience, the fear of absorption in the void and the fear of condensation to an infinitesimally small point. the ultimate of condemnation, the ultimate of compression. Now we can look at it now in another way by fusing these two views together. We can say, let us imagine a continuum of forces going right through this zone, the perimeter of which represents the boundary of our individuality. And we can say, we can imagine from infinity a force coming into this circle, characterizing the circle, and then going out again. And in coming in, changing its phase. And in going out in a different way from the way it was behaving prior to entering. If we like to do a number diagram of this, we can do so by drawing a line. So this line represents part of a curve. And if we were to continue, we'd draw a very big circle. And above the line means outside, and below the line means inside. And inside we write time, and outside we write eternity. And we've said before that time is to be determined by the emissions, time is emit, the breaker, by the emissions of energy. The infinite eternal power simply condenses on points in itself, and then from those points ripples spread out, and from each point a definite amount of energy is emitted, and the continuous emission of energies from these points gives rise to the time process. Serialization arises from the impulsive nature of the condensations of power in eternity. If we like to write time inside the circle and eternity outside the circle, we can see it just as clearly as the other way, except sometimes in philosophical works we'll find that eternity is talked about as above and time as below. And if we had a flat earth concept, we would tend to represent the diagram with the dividing line between the two, a straight line, eternity above, time below. And we might forget that this firmament, that is to say the firm place between the two forces, is really a curve. And when we consider this, we can consider from eternity into the time process a definite amount of energy comes, turns round and thus individuates, and then goes back into eternity. Now this is the birth and death of an individual. A definite amount of energy comes in from eternity, individuates, simply enspheres itself, turns round a certain number of times, and in the process of turning round develops itself, characterizes itself. When it has reached the term of its development, or even before it thus hits it, it departs from time into eternity. Now we see that in this flat earth diagram of it, we have the same thing that we could represent using the circular diagram, saying eternity winds into the center and then winds out again. In the process of winding in and winding out, we are presented with a sphere, here drawn as a circle for communion, as a zone into which energies enter from eternity, and from which energies enter into contingent relation with any other circles that have so come to exist. All the circles are individual beings within the eternal, are able to emit energy to other circles. And this emission of energy, absorbed by a finite, translated to another finite, produces the relation we call the contingent relation. Now you may remember that we said that the motion of eternity itself is said to be blissful because it is uninterrupted. Uninterrupted motion of the will is bliss. And at the eternality level, there can be no possible interruption of this motion. This motion is all there is. There isn't anything else. Power moving. we counterfly the concept of the static to it, and as it is a pure continuum of power, there can be no resistance whatever to its absolute motion, and therefore it must fulfill itself perpetually by its own motion. It is filled full, fulfilled of its own motion. But when we precipitate a circle, we have created a situation in which, because of the finite nature of the circle, only a definite amount of energy can come into the circle at any cross-section of time. The individual, then, stands as a zone, a locus, into which power is coming from the eternal, and from which is going into the time, force, individuated force. The super-individual force of eternity comes in, turns round, individuates, and makes power across to any other finite system, as well as returning at death to the eternal. Nothing goes up except that which came down. Nothing goes to eternity except the eternal force that involved itself in the time process. But because this circle can be viewed in two ways, as a recipient of eternal forces and as the point from which forces go from the time process, either to other points in the time process or back to eternity, so we can say that man is a kind of door. We can say that this circle now represents the hole through which forces are coming. Now we said that if we represent the sphere as substantial, suspended in a void, it feels isolated. But if we represent it as a whole, H-O-L-E, through which forces from eternity are passing, through it into time, then it does not feel isolated. So if we can conceive ourselves as void, as nothing, and as that through which power is passing, in reducing ourselves to nothing, we actually become a doorway to the powers of eternity. We can then see why the ancient philosophers recommended becoming nothing if possible. By becoming nothing, they meant being transparent, letting those forces from eternity press through us. Now, we have a point here very similar to a discussion we had recently about the concept in existentialist philosophy, Heidegger's concept of Dasein. We split this word, which is a German word made of two other words, Da and Sein. Da means there, and Sein means to be. So we can say there being. A there is simply a locus marked by power rotating. It's the same word as here plus T. Now if I say I am here, I am identified with the observing consciousness in this place. If I point to any other center outside this center, I call it a T here, a there. There's here and there. I mark the T for the word here to make there, to show that you are fixed as observed objects from the observation center at which this consciousness stands. Whereas the word here itself simply means the place where the power is felt. It's the hera root, and I feel intensity at this point. I see form elsewhere. The form I see, I do not feel the power of unless I empathically identify with it. So I don't feel exactly what you're all feeling now, unless I identify. And in not feeling it, I experience you merely as forms. So I put a T before the HR root to say, crucified form is there. Form is there fixed in the objects which I now perceive. But I know that if I were to change place with any one of those points, it would become a here for me. And this particular one, which is now here, would be a there, viewed from that point. Now, in this concept of Dasein, their being, it says that here the Absolute enters into individuated existence. And therefore, the individuated existence can be considered as a locus of evaluation. Every individual is then a center in which value occurs. Value means, we've said before, the will, stress, the importance. The power of eternity is importing itself into a given zone, and this importing, this carrying in, is the sole ground of asserting that there is value in it. There is no value unless the will wills into it. When the will wills into it, that is volition, you could call it value if you like. The reason we don't retain the O is because we have abandoned the idea of a sphere travelling through space, and we are considering a certain triangle of forces, a relation which requires a triangle to symbolise it. At the point of individuation, we see eternity expressing itself by becoming man. But we also see man exposing himself to the influx of eternity and time. So that whilst the Absolute is pressing in, now I'd point out here that Heidegger's analysis keeps using the word being for what we would term the Absolute. The reason is that he is not observing the literal significance of the letter B. We have said that we mustn't use the letter B unless we are referring to a finite, the symbol of which is a circle. If he had said non-being enters into being, it would have been more parallel with our terminology. We say you mustn't use the letter B unless you are symbolizing that which the closed mouth can symbolize, a closure of a zone. So from the non-closed, the eternal, comes into closure a certain amount of energy from the eternal. The infinite passes into finity, and in doing so, the finite zone is actually exposed to the temporal situation with other such zones also wound in. And according to the nature of the eternal force manifesting at any given locus, so is the exposure of that locus to the action and reaction with other loci. This means that if God, the Absolute, decided to load any given individual, then he would be placed on the spot. He would have to respond to the reactions of all other finite centers. So if we take the concept of Christ as the incarnation here, the incarnating spirit comes into Christ and moves him to say funny things to the rabbis. And the rabbis are moved to say funny things back, and he gets nailed up. Now, if the spirit had not moved him to say these funny things, then the spirit and the rabbis would not have moved them to say funny things back. So that when a man actually begins to embody eternal forces in himself, he has not only gained power from the eternal, he has also exposed himself to the effects of gaining power on other finite beings. So he stands in a very peculiar position between two worlds, between the eternal and the temporal worlds. And according to that which he invokes from eternity, so will he evoke from the temporal situation. Christ, who's a bit better to get people to expose themselves, challenges people who know. He says, which one of you, having a candle, sets it under a bushel rather than on a high place where people can see the light? He puts it in the form of a question, because he in fact did not expose all the candles he had, because he spoke in parables. Nevertheless, he says, which one of you, who will dare to say what he knows? Because if you speak what you know of the eternal, then all the temporal beings that do not yet know of that will react against what you say. So we say, in the locus of any individual human being, the infinite finds itself in existence and goes through the man into contingent relationship with other men. Now we know that words have significance, and philosophers generally try to find out the meanings of these things by etymological research. We find that in this particular instance, this existentialist thinker points out a special use of the word exist. He says, using the word in a certain sense, only man exists, that God does not exist, minerals don't exist, plants don't exist, animals don't exist, man exists. God has being and the rest of the universe has being, but man exists. Now he's obviously distinguishing here between two different usages of the word exist. As we have used the word, we have said that exist is ex sistere and means a wheel with six spokes. Now this wheel with six spokes is made by the impressing onto a center and the reaction from the center of that infinite power, bringing the wheel of being. And it is existent when viewed from another subsystem from outside. It stands out. Existere means that it is being out. It is shown, it is manifest. This is our use of the term. Now, in Heidegger's use of the term, he says that only man exists, the rest of the things don't exist, they have been. It is easy to understand what he means of God, that he doesn't exist, but has been, when we say that for God, being infinite, there is no out. Therefore, we cannot say of God, who has been seen by no man and is not manifest, not been made fast, not to be counted, we cannot say of him that he exists. The concept of the ek in exist is the concept that the thing has been viewed from outside itself. That God, being infinite, cannot be viewed from outside himself, and therefore he does not exist. That part we can easily understand about Heidegger's statement that God does not exist but has been. We remember we shouldn't really use the letter be of God at all in this sense. But when we come to look at the mineral world and the plant and animal world, and he still says these don't exist, but they have been, then we must consider another thing that we have dealt with before. That is, if we take a simple model of an atom, and it has a nucleus, and it has some attendant electrons, at least number being one, all the energy involved in the single electron spinning around a hydrogen nucleus, all that energy does not go out to the locus of the atom. It stays in it. We can, if we like, use a word out of Shakespeare and say it has insistere, not existere. It is insisting. None of the energy is going out of the atom. It is all spending itself, spinning round and round and round and round. And in this continuous spinning and changing of orbit, this energy is describing a sphere, but none of the energy involved in it is going out of it. Now, in this sense of the word, we can say it does not exist. All its energies are bound up inside itself, like certain pathological states of mind, where a person can actually be so locked up that they are deaf and blind to all external stimulation. They are insistent, not existent. Now, nevertheless, man exists, is his statement, and by this he means a certain amount of the energy of man goes out from man to search into other things. Man is busy exploding atoms, penetrating to the nucleus of it. He's busy penetrating everything. In this sense, his being is existent, which is going out from his finity. From the identification with the gross material body from which it starts, it goes out into other systems to investigate them. And this is his meaning of the word existent. We can easily line it up with our own usage by pointing this geometrical illustration, then we can see that it's quite easy to understand what is meant. Where any system has energy rotating inside it and the energy does not leave it, we can say it does not exist at all. It is in system. If Heidegger had said it is in system, then it would have been clear. It insists. Whereas if energy goes out from any system and impinges against another system and then returns, that person knows that he exists because he has sent out a certain amount of his energy, like Omar Khayyam, I sent my soul into the infinite, etc. And it has bounced back and given evidence, as we've had from Telstar in the last couple of days, that we really exist. We can go beyond ourselves. Now this going beyond our finite physical form from which we start is called transcendence. Transcendence means we are going across. We are going from inside the boundary beyond the boundary. And this process of transcendence is the process we call evolution. First of all, there's a settling impression that brings the body to being. And when we remember that sentience and power cannot be severed logically from each other, wherever a body comes to be, there is sentience being aware of that body. And in the space around the body, sentience is being aware of the space. Now this space beyond the body is the ground of the possibility of us becoming transcendent, that is, breaking identification with a given finite form. If we identify with any given form so that we forget that we are in fact transcendence become immanence, then at the point of identification we go under the law governing that kind of form. So if we say draw a bicycle and let this bicycle have squares, who identifies the concept of the wheel and the square has a bumpy round. In the same way, a man may have a bumpy character with which he identifies. He might have excrescences all over him psychologically. Insofar as he identifies with these particular characters, he goes under the law governing those characters. So that it becomes necessary, if one is to become efficient, to break identification with all those forms or characters within one's being, which would, in fact, produce a very noisy meshing with the knobs on other people's funny shaped wheels. The forces that go out from the centre across the barrier, the limiting perimeter of being, are transcending forces. And there is implied thereby that there must be forces descending. The trance across sending, going across, and then the descending means coming back into division again. When it goes beyond the circle, it goes beyond division. When it comes back into the circle, then it comes into division. So we say descend for when we move into this finite circle. So we ascend and transcend the limitation, and we come from ascension into descension, into division, and into dissension when we don't realize what we've done. We can say that, and we can name the infinite, eternal, transcendence, and Godhead, and whatever else we care to call it. All these are simply synonyms of the one fact that we are dealing with that which is not circumscribed, and therefore which is an absolute potential of all possibilities whatever, and at the same time is actually pure motion. It is a pure motion, a pure act, which is not finite. But that very same transcendence is coming in and becoming immanent. Immanent means that it is in, it is man, evaluation, it is the ent, or fixation of motion. It is inside the circle, it can be evaluated, and it is a fixed motion. That is immanent. Transcendent means it's gone across all those limitations, and yet this transcendent is this immanent. You remember the thing we've said before from Indian philosophy: as spirit was never lost and body can never be saved, what does salvation mean? It means realization of the fact that spirit cannot be lost and body cannot be saved. When we recognize that body simply means that zone considered as circumscribed, that's the B-O, and the D-Y, the affirmation of the division within it, mitosis and so on, within it, constitutes body. A body is simply a circumscribed zone used as a center of reference. And beyond the body is the no-body. And this no-body is transcendence. Remember William Blake's Nobody-Daddy in the poem about Klopstock? Nobody-Daddy means that he is nobody's daddy. That is to say, he has not fathered a body. He is the infinite, eternal Godhead. He's the void of Peer Gynt. He's the undetermined, the imponderable, and so on. All the words that are used to express the infinite can be reduced to the very simple one: don't draw a circle. If you do draw a circle, know that in drawing the circle you have imposed, put into your consciousness, a finite. If you identify with this finite and its characteristics, you become enslaved by your own definition. Nothing else can enslave you but your own definition. If we said, well, how does it happen that children born to the wrong parents, getting the wrong education, have imposed on themselves, we would have to go very, very deeply into the biological determinants that made them be born to particular parents. Also, we would have to observe this fact, that when a child is treated in a certain way by its educators, it has within itself centers of response. It can accept the imposition, or it can play wag and run away from school. What determines precisely which it does is a hidden mystery in the center of that being, because some little boys punished immediately come back for more, and some little boys punished don't need punishing again. The ones that don't need punishing again are called good boys. The ones that need punishing more than once are bad boys. Bad, of course, means that they are houses of division. They keep separating away from the punishers. Here then we have, in a concept of being there, being located in space, that a man, an individual, is a locus of the infinite, in the infinite, representing the infinite. He is that in which the infinite embodies, and at the same time he is that which, because he embodies it, is exposed to the logical implications of embodying it. And as there are other centers about, he is exposed also to contingent relation with other bodies. Now, you know that in existentialist theory, the basic idea that distinguishes it from classical philosophy is that one's existence precedes one's essence. The old view, your essence precedes your existence, is the statement that in eternity you already are a perfect form. The sort of Platonic idea. This perfect form winds itself in to the finite temporal body and then proceeds to impress itself in the time world. And then one exists, that is, becomes a wheel of being, after one has eternal being. First one is being, then one exists, becomes a wheel. The existentialist view says we are not allowed to consider being as such until we exist. Factually, the baby comes to exist before it studies metaphysics. So it has no concept of being as such, or of the absolute, until it comes to exist. And its first experiences as an existential being are that it is subjected to stimuli of various orders, which then proceed to characterize it. And the superimposed characters placed upon it condition its response and its mode of evolution. This being so, says the existentialist, each individual has the job of somehow bringing himself from the point of existence to his ultimate level, to his optimum, and this problem is his problem and nobody else's. He is a locus of evaluation, and he must make the evaluation. Nobody can do it for him. A cannot evaluate the effect of a stimulus on B at the point B. B must do it. And we say transcendently that A, who transcends A, becoming the absolute, can then identify with B and experience exactly what B is doing. This is the object of yoga. It is also empathically possible at a psychopathic level, where one person can identify with the feeling state of another and experience that state as if it were one's own. A baby does this with its mother in the first few weeks or months of its life. Here we have a center of evaluation in which each individual has to make up his or her own mind about the meaning of eternity, the meaning of its own being, and the meaning of time in contingent relation. If it makes a wrong evaluation, it's going to get a wrong effect. It has nobody to blame but itself. It is no good being A blaming being B for what A is doing. You cannot go out and strike against B and say you are responsible for my inner decision. It is A's own inner decision that has placed him initially within existence. Because he has come from eternity and the power acts only where it is, and the power acting in his place is responsible for his being and responsible for what happens to him. So that when we come to exist, we are faced with the necessity of making evaluations. We can't avoid it. If we say we reject evaluation, we have rejected evaluation itself only by evaluating it. We evaluate evaluation as nothing when we reject it, so that we cannot avoid making an evaluation. And when we do so, we suffer immediately the consequences of our own evaluation. This makes each individual absolutely responsible for his own response. He is not responsible for the stimulus that other beings give him. He is responsible for the nature of his reaction to those other beings. So that when Christ says, return good for evil, he's saying, if a man gives you an evil stimulus, excessive energy input, although he may be responsible for throwing the brick at you, it is your responsibility how you take it. And it cannot be anybody else's but the responsibility of the individual. This means that if we consider our physical body as a center of reference, a locus within the infinite, when we decide with which center to identify, we have placed ourselves under the law governing that center. In so doing, we have placed ourselves, by the mode of our stressing, within a field in which an infinite number of other centers exist. According to the way we respond, we will either repel or attract other beings. If we repel them in the wrong way, they will hit back very hard. And if we attract them in the wrong way, we will find a sort of agglutination process going on. They'll all adhere to us like funny little fish on the shark, and they will immobilize us. We see here that being attractive is not necessarily a good thing, and being repulsive is not necessarily a bad thing. Neither of them is either good or bad. Somehow you have to do both. You have to repel and attract simultaneously if you're to get the dual experience that you want. People who do not actually think carefully about this wish they were attractive. They would like to make friends and influence people. But if they were to succeed, they would be completely immobilized by the adherence. So at certain crucial points, they would be wiser to repel
But then you turn it out in the right way. Because the mode of that repulsion is going to determine the mode of the reaction. So there can be no quick jumping at the justification of repulsion here and saying, oh good, repulsion is permissible, therefore I will go about being repulsive and call this a spiritual exercise. If you repel in the wrong way, you have to pay the price of wrong repulsion. If you repel in the right way, you will get the reward of right repulsion. Now here, if any person whatever deceives himself in deciding to utilize a metaphysical truth for the advancement of his own individual power, he places himself in the position of having to pay the price of that choice. And you know that in Indian philosophy there's a concept here about the gods. It is said that the gods were all once human beings, but they were human beings who wanted power. And they identified with specific functions within the universe. One said, I would like to be in the sun and shine like man. Another said, I would like to be in the moon and keep going from circles to crescents and fooling people and so on. Now, the beings who identified in this way then got the job within cosmos. So there's a fellow stuck in the sun, shining like man, and he's bored stiff. And what he is saying and waiting for in the myth is the other twerp on earth who is saying, I wish I could be in the sun and shine. Because if that fellow on earth works very, very hard, he can come and have my job. So that all the gods are said to be in a state of great boredom with the jobs they have taken on, and they are hoping that human beings on earth will take over their positions of power and authority. To which end, it is said, they are deliberately sending messages to the earth to encourage egotistic pursuit of power. Now, St. Paul talks about corruption in high places, principalities and powers. And he says, here at this level, where we would expect the highest decency, we find the greatest corruption. There is the greatest differentiation. As the taste of power grows in an individual, so if he is not careful, he tends to identify. When he identifies, like the Bungalow of Rattles, he's got a job for years. Now, if he doesn't break his identification, he's stuck. But there is a cosmic law that says there's got to be a sun, and there's got to be a moon, and there's got to be stars, and so on. And therefore, no man who's taken on a job is allowed to leave it, unless he can dupe another man to take over his position. And therefore, whenever the likely lad with the gleam of the power pursuit in his eyes is seen, somebody above him who is bored stiff of the job pats him on the shoulder and says, I'll help you up. And at this point, every individual should be wary unless he feels deeply within himself the need for the experience of that which he has never previously experienced, namely boredom with power. When Christ was going to John the Baptist to be baptized, and John the Baptist said to him, I'm not fit to baptize you, Christ said, suffer it to be so now, for thus it becomes to fulfill all righteousness. Meaning to say that the infinite is prepared to do the most stupid thing, to make sure that nothing is left undone. So it comes down to that which is totally unfit and says to it, please baptize me because I'm an infinite being who's been baptizing myself for so long by my own infinite power, I feel very deficient because I've not been baptized by deficiency. So please do it. Now in this sense, any individual self-evaluating himself intelligently is right if he is prepared to pay the price, to go down and do any kind of job whatever, to the point of exhausting its significance before he moves on. There is no rule that says that you shouldn't do any given act, providing in the doing of it you are becoming more and more aware that you won't need to do it again. If we could say that the tendency of the eternal in entering into situations is to exhaust the meaning of that situation before it goes out again, we will explain that law in psychology called the law of the persistence of error. We know that when the eternal comes into a finite situation, because, as we've said before, this finite situation is a man, and this man has to pay the price of the entrance into him of eternality, so man, at that point, begins to cry out and say, well, Lord, I think I've had enough characterization for today, let's have a rest. And this thing is pouring in. And the man is saying, deliver me from these sufferings imposed upon me by the movement towards the optimum. But the universal, driven by the absolute, is entering into the particular, and the particular has to become universal. So although it cries to be released from the pressure of its own development, it is not allowed to do so. So we find, in fact, that an individual man will give up the idea of a certain stupid activity. Stupid means it's extremely painful. And he tries to get out of that activity. But the eternal force is coming in and saying to him, you haven't quite exhausted the meaning of that thing yet. So you must do it again. So we might find a man who comes into the world and he grows up and he reaches the marital state and he gets married and after about a period, a long period of about 5 minutes, he thinks, this is a mistake. He must get out. And so he rushes out, and immediately the infinite comes back in and says, well, if you don't want to do it there, do it here. It changes the colour of its hair. Now this is the persistence of error that puzzles the psychologist. It is simply the product of eternality forcing itself into the time process and repeating the thing until the lesson has been learned. And we can say this, that because eternality has more power than the finite has, it is going to win. Which means that every individual is going to have to do the same stupid thing over and over again until he penetrates to the meaning of it. Now if this is so, it means that if we really want to get out of it, we must agree to learn our lessons. And to do this, we actually have to concentrate on the job we are doing. We don't want to get out of it until it's painful. But if we want to get out of it because it's painful, we haven't yet understood the meaning of it, so we are bound to be represented with it. So while we are in it, we must exhaust the meaning of it. And only when we can stay in it without resistance, in full acceptance of it, can we be said to have understood the meaning of it. And only then will we be allowed to go out from that particular error and find another error to commit. If we manage to go through all the errors that there are, we finally go out back to eternity. We reach that stage when we've really exhausted the meaning of all possible errors. Actually, the half many errors is basically only two. One called putting in and the other called accepting. But when you have gone through all these, you come back to the eternal level from which Christ says, having attained that dizzy height, you shall go no more out. The movement to it requires that in relation with other beings and reflecting our energies emitted from the other being back into ourselves to see, in the words of Anthony Muley, what kind of fool I am. In this Anthony Muley song we see a man saying, why can't I fall in love? To see what kind of fool I am. He wants to know what kind of fool. He knows he's a fool, but he doesn't know what kind yet. Now, unless you fall in love, that is to say you identify with something, you cannot tell what kind of being you are. You know that if you identify, you are a fool. So that if you don't identify, you are not discovering what kind of fool. Now, to find out what kind of fool, all you have to do is select for yourself a series of carefully differentiated objects with which to identify. And each one will convince you of a certain aspect of your foolishness. And when you have tried out all the possible objects, of which we could say there are 12 main categories of identification, then you can return, having discovered the kind of fool you are, and you can then go out back to where you came from and stare at your original face in the mirror.